This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The international art world is abuzz with theft and intrigue. I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, specific objets d'art in the antiquities salons of many of the world's most famous museums are being called stolen goods. A former curator for the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles is on trial in Rome for allegedly acquiring looted Italian antiquities. Do these objects belong to the world at large or the country of origin? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the Vatican lays down the law. Candidates who practice homosexuality will be banned from the priesthood. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. The story reads like a Law and Order episode. An ancient urn showcased under glass at a major American art museum can be traced to a Polaroid of the object, covered in dirt, recently illegally excavated from a burial site in southern Italy. Controversy rages in the antiquities world over the acquisition of these precious artifacts. On Reporter's Notebook, a bit later, the Catholic Church formally condemned homosexual acts back in 1961, and today has set more specific guidelines, barring all prospective priests who exhibit deeply rooted homosexual tendencies. First, this news. The Washington Post reports today that Pentagon officials plan to bring back as many as 50,000 troops from Iraq by the end of 2006. That is a significant reduction, as many as a third of the total troops deployed there now. Is the military move a direct reaction to the congressional firestorm of last week, with Representative John Murtha's passionate plea to exit Iraq as soon as possible, or has today's withdrawal plan been in the works for some time? Well, earlier today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice had this to say regarding the planned withdrawal of troops.
I suspect that the American forces are not going to be needed in the numbers that they're there for all that much longer, because Iraqis are continuing to make progress in function, not just in numbers, but in their capabilities to do certain functions.
Joining us now is Bradley Graham, who's the Pentagon correspondent for the Washington Post, also co-author of today's article in the Post. Mr. Graham, thank you for being here.
Pleasure. Hi, Diana.
Hi. Listen, let's talk about the timing, first of all. I guess wonderful morale sort of announcement for Thanksgiving week and the holidays coming. But, you know, I assume that the military, the government's been working on this for a bit, but it is announced right as the debate has really come to a heated point, doesn't it?
Just to explain the timing, there was no effort to by the administration to have this reported by us today. In fact, I think the Pentagon's preference would have been to wait for this news until after the December 15th elections. But in any case, these plans have been in the works for months and months. Last spring already, top commanders in Iraq were signaling the possibility of beginning troop reductions by early in 2006. The reason the story appeared today was because we were just doing some reporting this week and got more details on how the plans were beginning to firm up, at least for the initial phase of reductions early next year, when they're thinking about bringing back about 3 of the 18 combat brigades that are in Iraq at the moment.
I guess that brings me to the logical question then. If this debate was so heated, so vitriolic last week on the congressional floor, why wasn't this announcement made last week? It would have assuaged a lot of feathers last week.
The administration and the Pentagon have been signaling for some time that they hope to begin a phased withdrawal next year, and that's been understood, I think, by many people involved in the debate. They have not, however, wanted to announce the details of which units might not be going and so on until they see how the December 15th elections go, and they get through that period, and can then gauge how fast the new government is being created, what the strength of the insurgency is, and some other factors.
When you mention, and you have twice now, the December 15th elections, then it will be much more clear to both government and military officials as to just how permanent and how stable that government will be, and just how quickly and how many people we can withdraw?
The elections are clearly a huge milestone, and there is a great expectation that the Sunnis who sat out last January's vote for the transitional government will turn out in much larger numbers this time, and so the result will be a set of elected officials who are more representative of the ethnic mix in Iraq. It still may take some time, though, to form a government. This transition government took 2 or 3 months to form last winter and spring, but you know, the Pentagon and the rest of the Bush administration expects to be into a different phase after the elections.
You write in today's article that there is some concern about Iraq's new police force not being terribly effective. And how about the army itself? Do we know both police and how the Iraqi army development is going at this very moment?
The army is in better shape than the police, but the army still has a ways to go. The military has developed a very extensive system for rating the readiness of army units, and report that that several score Iraqi battalions are now in the fight, in the lead in the fight in Iraq, in a number of cases operating alongside U.S. forces, but they still lack a lot of the logistical support that militaries need: truck drivers, engineers, medics, aviation, intelligence, that kind of support. And so U.S. forces are expected to have to provide that for years to come. The police are much further behind. That's been a bigger problem for U.S. forces to develop.
Okay. Thank you so much, Bradley Graham, Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post.
You're welcome.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. I'll be back in a moment with more of To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. You're on vacation in New York or Chicago or Atlanta. It's a rainy afternoon, and you've decided to spend a few hours at the city's principal art museum. You wander into the antiquities wing and imagine the civilizations of Rome and Greece as you peruse the images painted on the vases and bowls from so many centuries ago. What you don't realize is that there's a good chance the objects you're looking at may have been stolen. Rules on the acquisition of antiquities are in constant flux. They change country to country, era to era, and that confusion has led to current criminal charges against one of the world's most respected antiquities curators. It's a fascinating subject, and here to kick it off for us today is Tracy Wilkinson, who's the Rome Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Ms. Wilkinson, thank you for your time.
Hi, how are you?
Well, good. I understand that the high-profile curator, by the way, I'm referring to is Marion True, who's the former curator at the J. Paul Getty Museum here in Los Angeles, now facing criminal charges in Rome. And I understand, Ms. Wilkinson, that you've been covering that trial. Would you please spell out for our listeners first just the specific allegations against Ms. True?
Right. Well, the trial has finally started. She is accused of criminal conspiracy to acquire stolen goods and illicit receipt of archaeological items that allegedly had been illegally taken from excavation sites in Italy. She was the antiquities curator, as you said, at Getty being one of, you know, without doubt, the most prestigious museums in the world. So it's quite an interesting case because, you know, for the first time, I think we're really seeing a museum, though the museum itself is not indicted, still to see someone so closely connected with the really essence of the museum to be brought before a criminal court is really fascinating.
And it's not only fascinating, but it's highly ironic, isn't it? Because Ms. True developed a reputation for setting forth at the Getty, at least in the United States, one of the most stringent policies in terms of documenting antiquities acquisitions.
Well, indeed, I guess there's some irony there. On the one hand, yes, she had spoken out quite a bit about those issues and about the importance of following where these items came from. On the other hand, according to the Italian prosecutors, she knowingly, or at least turned a blind eye when items were offered to her that had been taken from Italian sites, and especially in southern Italy, and you know, acquired them for the Getty. So there's something of a contradiction there that I suppose will eventually be ferreted out.
Yeah, talk to us a little bit about the level of the Italian culture officers' indignation. Just what the emotional factor is about these objects and how they feel about them being acquired or trafficked illegally.
Right. Well, you know, it must be said, quite frankly, that I think a lot of Italian officials sort of looked the other way for many years while a lot of this stuff was being looted or taken. And, you know, that cannot be forgotten. On the other hand, today there are several prosecutors and cultural ministry officials who are saying enough is enough. And not only do we want these items back, which is one element of this prosecution, they also are saying they want this to stop, that no longer should smugglers and grave robbers, as they're called in Italy, be allowed to come in and, you know, willy-nilly take what they want and then have major museums be complicit, as the Italians say, in smuggling them out and then laundering them, essentially, and putting them into the best museums in the world. So they want the practice to stop. Not only do they want these items back, to the extent they can get them back, they also want the practice to stop.
You know, we are going to have a lawyer on with us later who practices cultural heritage laws, and I have a number of legal questions. But you know, you just brought up, you called it grave robbing. You just brought up a subject that I'm sure our listeners are curious about. So, you know, when we hear about a Matisse or a Gauguin has gone missing, it's been, literally been lifted in the middle of the night with someone wearing black gloves and, you know, tremendous technology off a wall of a museum or a private collection in a home. But here, the way I understand it, an excavator might go down to the backyard of a home of a farmer in southern Italy and literally dig up something that's 2,500 years old and take it home. And I'm curious, is that really owned by the Italian government? Is it owned by that farmer because that's his land and he had every right to sell it? I don't know what the actual legality is.
Well, under the law, patrimony, in other words, items of that age, are part of the belong to the state, the Italian government, essentially the Italian state. So yes, you cannot remove those items from the farmer's backyard and take them out of the country. In most cases, they are to be either left on site or put into a museum. But you are right about the extent to which this exists. There are so many archaeological sites all over Italy. Italy is enormously rich in items. I have an archaeological dig in my backyard. I live in Rome, and they're digging items that are about 2,000 years old out of my backyard.
You're kidding.
So it's not unusual.
And
you've
stood there and actually seen them come out of the earth?
Yes, I watched them, and there is now a museum that has been built on the edge of this site where these things are being now recovered and exhibited. Many an excavation or a construction project in Rome has had to be stopped because they hit some sort of valuable archaeological find, ruins of some sort. So it's not unusual for this to happen. And the Italians, have not always been very diligent about keeping track of everything and monitoring it. But that's what the prosecutors now going after the Getty and other museums are trying to change.
Well, back to the Getty case and the charges being brought against Marion True, the way I read it is that the prosecutors have really lucked out. 10 years ago, actually, when they raided that Swiss warehouse of the convicted art smuggler Giacomo Medici. Tell us a little bit about what that raid discovered and how, you know, that sort of brought a preponderance of evidence that in many cases just don't exist.
Yes, what they found, among other things, in his offices were pictures, Polaroid photographs of items that were still on the ground. They clearly had just been taken out of the ground, and some of those items could then be traced to museums. So that was sort of a smoking gun, if you will. It showed that this was something that had been dug up, within the last few years and taken out of the country, which is illegal. So it was an unusual amount of evidence, photographic evidence, that they used to convict Medici and are now trying to use to convict Marion True.
And in the 10 years, have the Italians been trying hard to trace those objects?
Yes, they've been trying hard to trace those objects, having traced, I think, about 40 to the Getty, and are now also going after other museums in Boston, New York, and elsewhere. So little by little, yes, they have tracked down quite a few of those items.
Well, it's an interesting case to be covering, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's fascinating to watch someone like Marion True, being whisked into an Italian courtroom for this kind of prosecution. It is fascinating.
And by the way, if she is found guilty, do you have any idea what the punishment would be?
Well, the prosecutor hasn't said yet what he'll ask, but just looking at Medici, who's already been convicted on more or less the same charges, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, though he is appealing. So you could expect something like that for Marion True, although I would expect it might be a little less, and whether she ever actually serves any time, obviously, is another question. But I would expect it to be in that range.
Okay. We're speaking with Tracy Wilkinson, who's the Rome Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times and covering the Marion True Getty case over in Rome at the moment. Let's broaden out from the Getty now and talk to Anna Summers Cox, who's publisher and editorial director of The Art Newspaper. She's also a member of the British Illicit Trade Advisory Panel, which advises the British government on how to prevent and prohibit the illicit trade in cultural objects. Ms. Summers Cox, thank you very much for being with us.
Not at all. Hello.
Hello. Well, let's talk first of all, as I said, let's broaden out from the Getty. I mean, in preparing for today's show, I have read some statements, elsewhere in different publications that you can virtually walk into any museum in the Western world and be assured that several, at least, of the antiquities objects, have been illicitly acquired. Can we really make a statement that big and broad?
No, you can't. The reason being that the major museums of Europe and quite a lot of American museums have a policy of not buying anything without a proper documented background. And it's the nature of things that have been illegally dug up and smuggled out that they don't have this background. And so, for example, the British Museum does not have things that have been dug up illegally. In modern times, the laws in the countries that have many archaeological items are all relatively recent.
I see. So there, that's where it really comes down, isn't it? Because, we'll take, right in your home country there, the British Museum. I mean, they're probably the largest case I can think of with this is those gorgeous Elgin marbles that have been there, 200 years, taken from the Parthenon in Athens. The Greeks constantly argue, say, they're ours. We want them back. But here the issue has to do with time as to when, how long they've been there and maybe a bit how well they're being taken care of. Is that part of the issue as well?
I think there's great confusion in people's minds about this. I think one reason why very respectable institutions considered it okay to buy objects with an illegal past is that they have been saying, well, the source countries, the countries with these big archaeological holdings, have unreasonable laws, laws that penalize the private citizen. We've just heard how, you know, if you find something in your back garden, it doesn't belong to you. They don't look after things well themselves. We, on the other hand, we put them into a wonderful context. We study them. We make them available. And in a sense, we have more right to them than the source country. Now, I think this has confused people's moral sense. A museum that wouldn't dream of buying pirated software for its computers or would break the law, although it wasn't the law of its own country, it would break somebody else's law. And I think that the last 10 years has been a whole change in the attitude towards who owns what and the finer sense of the legality of things because of all the restitution issues to do also with the Second World War, and museums have been looking into their holdings and finding out whether they really have a total right to certain objects and so on. And so people's moral sense has been sharpened. The Swiss, for example, used to have a kind of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil attitude, hence all these free ports stuffed full of things that came from God knows where. And they, the reason why Giacomo Medici was caught was because the Swiss actually let the police in for the first time. And the British recently have signed up to UNESCO International Treaty on the recovery of stolen goods. So we're living through a changing sensibility.
It is changing, and I suppose for that reason, whether it be Marion True in the Getty case or other curators and directors of museums all around the world, you know, perhaps we could find some sympathy or some empathy as to, you know, their actions. I mean, you know, you look at there's the 1939 Italian law prohibiting unauthorized removal of antiquities, but that goes in contrast somewhat to the 1970 UNESCO Convention calling on governments to make it illegal to import and transfer ownership of particular antiquities. I find it all very confusing in reading through it myself. So there is no uniform law. Look, it's got to be this date. It's got to have this kind of documentation. And do you think that that very particular sort of uniformity needs to be established worldwide?
I think that that's crying for the moon. I don't think one's going to get that. I think that what we must try and work towards is a greater collaboration between countries, because quite clearly the system doesn't work at the moment. Even if the small number of big museums left in the world who buy illicit antiquities stop doing that, there will still be private collectors. There will still be a hidden trade. And there is a hidden trade because these things get dug up in these countries. There are people who are specialized in it. The tomb robbers, for example, of southern Italy have sometimes done it from father to son for generations. They live off it. They will go on doing it as long as there is a market for it. And to kill off a market, as we all know from the old prohibition times in the US, to kill off a market for something for which there is a demand is extremely difficult. I think there needs to be a complete rethinking of the whole system whereby there is a certain proportion of goods which can be traded legally. And those items will then become the more valuable ones, and that will suffocate the market for items that don't have a kind of a passport, you know, a certificate of conduct.
Okay. Ms. Summers-Cost, would you do us a favor and stay with the conversation? We're just going to take a short break, and we'll be back with someone who can speak on behalf of the museum curators and with an expert in archaeology as well. We'll be back in just a minute with more of To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're discussing the legal rights of countries where ancient artifacts originated. And joining us now for the conversation is Maxwell Anderson, former director of the Association of Art Museum Directors, former assistant curator of Greek and Roman art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Mr. Anderson, thank you for chiming in.
Thank you. For- very much for having me.
All right. Well, you know, we've been speaking a bit about the Getty case going on in Rome at the moment, and evidently just yesterday, was it, the Met, where you used to be a curator, assistant curator of Greek and Roman art, as I said, has made some concessions and said that they will return to Italy now some of their ancient artifacts. Do you sense that the Italians are, shall we say, on a roll, and this is going to change a lot of the practices at museums, at least in the West?
Well, I think what's happened in recent years is a function of two things. One, yes, this spectacular trove of evidence that clearly shows objects that were recently excavated or dug up illegally and are now being identified. And the other change is a change in U.S. law very recently with the Schultz case. And that's the first time in the U.S. on a large scale that a person was criminally indicted and went to prison for purchasing objects which were revealed to have had an invented background.
Give those of us who don't know a little bit better detail on the Schultz case.
Well, Fred Schultz, an antiquities dealer in New York, was in the case of this litigation accused of having purchased an Egyptian antiquity and helped to doctor the background or provenance of the object, and he was indicted for the violation of Egyptian law. And this is the first time that that's happened in the States, the formal acknowledgement of a foreign power's laws around export of antiquities. And so the very function, the fact that he had participated, it seemed from the evidence, to have manufactured documents that made it appear to have been legally exported, was the basis of his trial and imprisonment.
And you're getting to the crux of one of the big issues here, aren't you? The international versus national law, and even different national laws within different countries.
Yeah, the outset of the program had this scenario of someone walking in not realizing something was stolen. Well, there are two things to bear in mind. In the U.S., the vast majority of works of art in major public museums are through gift and bequest from private individuals. So there is a smaller fraction of works that are actually purchased. The Getty is obviously a place where the majority of the works have been purchased, mm-hmm. because their reputation is such when their collection has such works because they have the money to buy it. But by and large, that's not the case. And so when someone acquires from a second, third hand, or a fourth hand objects, they don't always come with a passport. And what's changing now because of the Schultz case is an obvious need on the part of American institutions in particular, which are very active in the market, as, by the way, have been German museums, for example, have to now look down the road to see that the burden of proof shifts to the buyer. And that is certainly is a change which is going to help, as Anna Summers Cox was saying, begin to shift presumably the ways in which the market works.
Well, I've heard you say, when you talk about shifting in the way the market works, I've heard you quoted before as saying what was adventurous back in the 1980s is now criminal. Has it really changed that much in 20 years?
Yes, and again, it's that one piece of legislation which took the museum world and, frankly, the rest of the world that considers antiquities by surprise, because what it opens up now is the possibility of any foreign power declaring a year after which any object that's left its soil is considered stolen. And so as you think about all the galleries around the world that have works of art which may have entered their collections after that date, they all notionally are subject to some kind of claim. But the predicament there is that going backwards in time and beginning to uproot every object which may have that issue attached to it is not only an impossibility in terms of the practice of law, but it also probably doesn't help solve the problem going forward, which is at least as important. And that's how, as you were suggesting and Anna Summers Cox was pointing to, there must be a way going forward that's different.
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you could give us some insight. I'm not speaking about, you know, you particularly, but just a curator, the job of being a curator, director of a major museum. Acquiring objects is sort of where you make and break your reputation and break and make the reputation of the entire museum. So I assume that if the laws are fairly nebulous, someone comes to a curator and has something that they can say, well, it's, you know, it's been in a private collection for many decades now, and I have it to offer you. There's a temptation not to have the particular documentation that might be warranted, just to get that under glass in your museum, isn't there?
Well, it is the point of view, I think, of many museum professionals in the U.S. is there are many works that come out of the ground not through clandestine excavations by criminals, but by chance finds. There's a UK government report this month that this year in Britain alone, 67,000 artifacts were discovered by chance in people's backyards. And so the issue of what to do with all that material is, yes, you could certainly put it in the basement of the British Museum, but the issue that it raises in terms of other opportunities down the road for long-term loans or exchanges or interstate agreements, intergovernment agreements, seems to be essential. Because if one simply freezes the market, it isn't going to address the issue of chance finds, which are obviously a major issue, not just in Britain, but everywhere. And it won't help institutions that are dedicated to public education and to the furtherance of our understanding of the ancient world do their job.
I want to bring Anna Summers Cox back in now to respond a little bit about this. Ms. Summers Cox, when we talk about it, Maxwell Anderson's now talking about the huge volume of antiquity objects all around the world, and I was just reading that just in the basement of the Via Giulia alone in Italy, that there is more stuff and better stuff than at the Metropolitan Museum, the Boston Museum, and the Getty all put together, but it hasn't been studied. There are not the resources to conserve it, to catalog it, and to put it out there to the public. So I'm a little confused as to the Italian, the motivation of the Italians to claim everything of their own. Is it partly financial? They want the money that these goods are being sold to these museums? Or is it all national pride?
It's national pride. And there are two separate issues. One is you don't want to see your laws made a mock of. You don't want to see other countries flaunting objects which have been the cause of breaking laws. And then there's the other issue, which is that of the tendency of curators to accumulate, not to publish, not to display, to be dogs in a manger, not to lend. For example, there's an excellent suggestion about 15 years ago by an Italian senator that the Italian museums make large, long-scale loans to museums abroad, particularly in America, so they would have good things to show, which would help stifle the market in illicitly excavated goods. And that got shot down on grounds of pure nationalism. I remember one man who'd been the mayor of Rome said, and supposing they didn't give them back, what would you do? Would we have to send warships?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're on very emotional territory here. I think for America, you'd have to think gun law for the same degree of knee-jerk emotional reaction. And this is not the way to go forward. As Maxwell Anderson said, it's going to have to be collaborative. There a lot of these countries are countries which either are still quite poor, the countries around the southern edge of the Mediterranean, or countries that remember being poor, like Italy. And they're still smarting from the times, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, when the rich northerners came down, the Milordis from Britain, and basically took away whatever they felt like taking away.
Mm-hmm. This is a great time to bring in Patty Gerstenblith, who's a professor of law at DePaul University, an expert in cultural heritage law, also co-author, interestingly, of Iraq, Beyond the Headlines, History, Archaeology, and War. Professor Gerstenblith, thank you for being with us.
Yes, glad to be here.
Let's expand then, because, Ms. Summers Cox now is bringing up not only Italy and Greece, but other countries around the Mediterranean, and you have some expertise in Iraq and the Middle East. So this isn't just this Italian case. This has become an absolute worldwide situation, hasn't it?
Yes, definitely. I would like, before I launch into some of that, to comment on some of what the speakers before me just said.
Okay, go ahead.
The last thing, point about, I think it was Anna Summers Cox made about long-term loans from Italy. That situation has changed in the last few years. Italy has changed its law in 2004 that it now allows loans of up to 4 years to institutions in other countries. It used to be a limit of 6 months. And this was a significant change in their law and shows that they are very interested in working with other institutions in a collaborative and cooperative manner.
And even in this current potential deal they're making with the Met, they're talking about perhaps, longer-term loans. And
right. They're talking even about changing their law again to allow up to 8 or 12-year loans, let alone some arrangement they may work out with the Metropolitan on a particular basis in exchange for the Metropolitan recognizing Italy's ownership rights to some of the artifacts that are at issue.
Can I throw in, do you agree with Ms. Summers Cox's sort of assessment that this truly is national pride and pride
well,
and heritage? And
I
not
think
money?
That we're forgetting, this was a second point I wanted to make, we're forgetting what is really at stake in these kinds of cases. It's not just a matter of national pride. No one so far has mentioned what happens and what is lost when an archaeological site is looted. Archaeological sites contain the remains of past civilizations. They consist of architectural remains, faunal and floral remains, tombs contain human skeletons, textual material, artifacts of ceramics, metal, stone, sculptures, and on and on. The only way to truly understand the past is to have archaeological sites excavated scientifically, so that all the artifacts of a particular time period may be found in association with each other, and the full past can be reconstructed. This is how we all learn. It's just not a matter of the Italians learning about the past in Italy. It's how Americans learn about the past in Italy or any other country in the world. When sites are looted, all this information is lost, and you're left with an object that is muted, that can't tell us about its past history.
So there's a disservice to both science, to anthropology, to history in general.
Absolutely, and this is the primary value. If museums claim to be protecting the past and are educational institutions, then it's not enough for them, as Dr. Anderson said, to preserve individual objects. They need to be worried about preserving the complete context from which these artifacts come. And it's only through that that the American public can truly be educated about the past, or that our history texts can be written.
Now, wait a second. Let me take a pause, because you have so much to say. There's so much I want to ask you, but stay right with us. Let me go quickly back to Maxwell Anderson, former assistant curator of Greek and Roman art at the Met in New York, and get a response to that. You know, with the museum's point of view, oh, there's an excavation site with gorgeous urn. We need to have that. Let's go excavate it. Let's bring it back with proper documentation, let's say. But what about the entire perspective, the anthropological perspective of disturbing that site?
Well, that, of course, as Professor Gerstenblatt says, that's the best way to learn about an object, is how it functioned in an ancient world and the ways in which it correlates to other objects in the same find. And that's the ideal scenario. And in the old days in this country, there was such a thing as partage, in which universities, great universities like the University of Pennsylvania, would actively work and excavate sites around the world and receive, as a consequence, works from that excavation, fully licensed, in a sense, by the host country, the source country. What we're into now, though, is two things. One, so many of the objects that appear on the art market are arriving without any kind of background, and the choice that museums have made until now has been to say, isn't it better to have an object which might otherwise reside within the art market alone or end up in a private collection be put on public display and have a chance not only of being published and known, but perhaps retrieved? Now, the counter-argument is, how can you find evidence of an object for which has been looted and there is no possibility of retrieving it, which is, of course, the argument that's being made so forcefully by the archaeological community, and to which the only response is the U.S. has not been, until the Schultz case, boldly declarative about this situation. Foreign countries have been, but American law until Schultz did not, in fact, make it illegal to have an object in this country that was fully documented as an import to the U.S. And so things are changing, I think, in ways that will acknowledge the issue of context as indispensable when it's available. What it doesn't resolve, of course, is what we were talking about earlier, which is the number of objects that appear without any papers as a consequence of there being chance finds.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to Professor Gerstenblatt then, and I apologize. You're just so knowledgeable and have so much to say, but I would really like to get some statement from you as to, you know, we're focused so much today on Italy and the particular, you know, objects under question at the Getty. But, you know, you've written this book on Iraq. We of course, there are thousands and hundreds of thousands of objects out of China. Give us a worldwide sort of professorial view, would you?
Okay, I'm going to do that in 1 second. One last comment I have to make.
Okay.
Dr. Anderson said that the Schultz case was the first time that that represented a change in U.S. law, and I have to correct that. There were two cases in the 1970s of dealers who were convicted in the United States for doing exactly what Mr. Schultz did. One involved Mexico, and the other involved Guatemala. And secondly, it's not a prosecution or enforcement of a foreign country's law. In all these cases, the American dealers were prosecuted and convicted under something called the National Stolen Property Act, which is a U.S. law. And this will allow me to go into other countries. Many countries have had national ownership laws since the beginning of the 20th century. The Italian law actually goes back to 1902, not 1939, as it's frequently said. The law in Iraq protecting archaeological sites goes back to the 1930s, and so on. Mexico, many countries in South America go back throughout the 20th century. So this is actually not anything new. And for American dealers, collectors, or museums to say suddenly now they are caught off guard, I must say is somewhat disingenuous. But as for the worldwide scope of the problem, yes, this is something that's gone on. It goes on in the United States. There's looting of archaeological sites in the Southwest in the U.S., Native American sites. It goes on in Central America, where Mayan sites and Maya stelae mm-hmm. have been cut apart for the last 30 or 40 years because they're very popular on the American market. There are, I just saw recently, photographs of human skeletons littering the beaches in Peru. Because the textiles in which these skeletons were, humans were buried, these textiles are very popular on the market in the United States. And the looters come in and they take the textiles and they leave the human remains just scattered on beaches and around the archaeological sites. In Iraq, the looting of the museum, of course, in 2003 received a great deal of attention. What has received less attention is that the archaeological sites, particularly in southern Iraq, are being looted on a massive scale, with estimates of 200,000 to 300,000 objects being removed over the space of a year or so.
500,000 in a year, huh?
Well, about 200,000 to 300,000 in a year. Mm-hmm. But I would guess over the last 2.5 years, you're easily talking about that kind of level. Another issue is that, take for example, in Iraq. When a site is looted, not only is the context of the site itself destroyed, but only the most saleable pieces, the pieces that are considered most desirable on the market, are actually saved. The others are destroyed. So, for example, broken cuneiform tablets are discarded because why bother with a broken one when there are so many whole ones that are available? Cylinder seals are easily hidden and transported. And thousands of these were removed. Almost 5,000 were stolen from the Iraq Museum. But we can't imagine how many countless tens of thousands are, in fact, as we speak, being looted out of archaeological sites in southern Iraq.
You paint a vibrant picture. There is a massive, it's a massive scale of excavation and looting. I'm sorry, I'm so sorry, but we are running out of time, and I just want to wrap this up on the museum end with Anna Summers Cox again. Do you think you could just lay it out real simply for us, Ms. Summers Cox? How will all this affect the role of museums as houses of world culture?
Well, if the museums of the source countries, that is the countries that have a lot of archaeological material, will be generous and lend, then it shouldn't affect the museums at all. In fact, it should improve things because ideally then the curators will be collaborating together, they will be sharing information. And I completely agree with Professor Gerstenberg's point about context, that you need to know where something's come from because there is so much more in a tomb than just the one masterpiece object that ends up in the market.
Yes, of course.
In New York. I think this is ultimately a positive development, but I go back to my original point, which is that you have to get the citizen, the man in the street, on your side if you want to protect the archaeological antiquities of your country, because they're going to be finding them when they dig roads, when they sink a well, The reason why we know that 63,000 objects were discovered in Britain is because in Britain, if you find something and you go and declare it to the local archaeological officer, he says, you're a great fellow, and they put it immediately onto the web, and you get given the credit for having found it. And so you feel you're doing your bit as a good citizen. If in lots of the source countries you were so foolish to go to the local police station and say, I've just found this, not only would it be confiscated, but quite probably they'd come and raid your house to see whether you had anything else tucked away. So you wouldn't feel good about it, you'd feel very bad about it. Now, this is not the way to protect anybody's archaeological heritage.
All right. We thank you very much. It's been quite an education today from Anna Summers Cox from the Art newspaper in London. Thank you so much for your time. Tracy Wilkinson was with us as well from the Los Angeles Times, working out of Rome. Maxwell Anderson, formerly of the Met in New York, and Professor Patty Gerstenblith gave us some good key advice on and insight on archaeology around the world in this respect. Thank you to all our guests. On a reporter's notebook in just a minute, the Vatican announces new guidelines to formally ban homosexuals from becoming priests. Be back in just a minute for more of To the Point from PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Largely in response to the sexual abuse scandal within the Catholic Church, the Vatican today announces new specific guidelines banning individuals who practice homosexuality from the priesthood. The wording of the document has been immediately criticized by gay rights activists as rejecting standards considered normal and natural in the scientific community. We welcome to the program John Allen, who's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter, author of Opus Dei. John Allen, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Diana.
Well, let's first lay out, you know, what the document says.
Well, bear in mind the document has not yet been officially issued by the Vatican. We're responding to a leak of a text that was published by an Italian news agency, although I don't think there's any real doubt about the legitimacy of the text. What it says is that men who have not been celibate for 3 years or who participate in the so-called gay culture or who have deep-rooted homosexual tendencies should not be ordained priests. Of course, the $64,000 question is, what does deeply rooted homosexual tendencies mean? And because the document doesn't define the term, most of the experts that I've talked to believe that what it will mean in practice is that those bishops and superiors and seminary rectors who want to take a very hard-line stance against the admission of gays will certainly be empowered to do so. Those who want to take a more flexible case-by-case approach will probably find enough latitude to be able to continue doing that.
Yeah, and I must say that some of the criticism coming forth at the moment, you know, in response to this particular, you referred to the 3 year sort of rule, that this phrase, if a man had transitory homosexual tendencies that have been overcome for at least 3 years, he may be admitted to a seminary. And there are, you know, the gay rights activists and sympathizers come right out and say that this church doesn't have a clue, does not understand homosexuality. Or sexuality, period.
Yeah, you're right. That certainly would be the criticism from the homosexual community. I suppose the defense that the Vatican and at least some bishops who are sympathetic with this ruling would put up would be that, you know, if you're dealing with a situation that is in an all-male priesthood in which the temptations and the pressures that homosexual candidates would face are simply greater, and that therefore, from their point of view, that calls for a higher standard, that is, for greater care, greater vigilance, and that sort of thing. I think essentially what the document is trying to say is that if a bishop is going to ordain a candidate with a homosexual orientation, although the document doesn't use that word, that he ought to be extremely confident that person is not going to violate his vows of celibacy.
And when you bring up the vows of celibacy, there are other critics who say if a man takes a vow towards celibacy, what does it matter whether he's gay or heterosexual? He has vowed to be celibate.
Yeah, I think the point of view in the Vatican would be that it's naive to say that it doesn't matter whether he's gay or straight, because When you're in a seminary, of course, you are spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in the company of other young men. When you get out into the priesthood, you have a much greater chance of having unmonitored or unsupervised contact with young men than you do with young women, and therefore their argument would be that it makes a difference, and that bishops and superiors and rectors and so on ought to take a much harder look at those candidates.
What do you think about the timing? You know, as we mentioned in the beginning, it's been since the early 60s since a mandate was put out by the church regarding homosexuality. And now, is this the culmination of the last few years' sexual abuse scandal that hits the headlines, you know, almost daily?
Well, the work on this document actually began in 1994, so well before the white-hot period of the scandals that began, as you know, in 2001 with the revelations from Boston.
Did you say 1994?
That's right. That's okay. When work on the document began. And I think at the time it was a response to a perception in the United States and elsewhere that there was a disproportionate number of homosexuals in the priesthood. Now, certainly the scandals have added fuel to the fire. Vatican officials and, again, some American bishops would look at the fact that, according to the U.S. bishops' own survey conducted by the John Jay College in New York, some 80% of the cases of sexual abuse documented in the states involved same-sex contact, that is, contact between a priest and a male, either an adolescent or a younger child. And they would draw from that the conclusion that that homosexuals are, to a certain extent, at greater risk for that kind of thing in the priesthood. And again, I say, therefore, the point from their point of view would be to call bishops and other superiors to a much higher standard in terms of evaluating homosexual candidates.
Would you think, last question, if you would, Mr. Allen, will this just simply prompt priests to remain in the closet and quiet?
Well, I think there will be some of that. I think there certainly will be some young gay Catholic men who might have been considering a vocation to the priesthood who will simply decide not to come forward because of this document. I think the real impact, however, will probably be that young gay Catholic men who want to become priests will simply shop around. That is, they will find religious orders or dioceses where the bishops and the superiors are sympathetic. There are already some American bishops who have said that's the approach they intend to take, including the president of the Bishops' Conference.
Mr. Allen, thank you very much. We're out of time. I appreciate it, though. John Allen. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Sharon Rimbaum and Jonah King, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online at moretothepoint.com. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.